One of the most frequent questions we receive about products, particularly in Israel, is that very often a person will go to the supermarket, they'll pick up a product, and on the product, there'll be some, you know, one Israeli hashkacha or another, Adatze de Charedis, Rav Landau, and next to that, it will say, there'll be a little stipulation, Yemot HaShana Bilvad. Right, for year-round use only. And then somewhere on the package, injected, maybe next to the barcode or next to the production date or something like that, it will be kasher lePesach. Now, they want to know what's going on. In other words, one hashgacha says that it's Limot HaShana Bavad, there's inkjetted somewhere else in the package that it's kasher lePesach. So what's the situation? So I explain it like this. What happens is in Eretz Yisrael, because there's various levels of Ashkacha, so to speak, various agencies, there's the local Rabbanut that has to certify something that legally will take a step back and look at the legal perspective. In Israel, there's no separation between church and state. And like most places in the world, many places in the world, there is kashrus fraud. Some places kashrus fraud would be not so much a rabbinic issue as much as a consumer fraud type of issue, right? The same way that if I would write on a product that it's gluten-free and it's not gluten-free, or that it's vegan and it's not vegan, so somebody would be able to say, hey, you said it's vegan and it's not. So in America, for instance, if somebody writes kosher on a product and it can be proven that it's not kosher according to kosher laws, so they can be sued at least in most states, and I think maybe even on other levels, but in many places they can be sued for kashrus fraud. I don't want to get into all the intricacies and all the legal systems and all the pitfalls, etc. But on a certain level, in many places, in many around the world, somebody could be sued for kashrus fraud, which would really be a form of consumer fraud. In Israel, it goes a step beyond that. That because there's a rabbanut, and the rabbanut should be the body that's going to decide what's kosher and what's not kosher, so it becomes that there's a legal auditing system, similar to the IRS for taxes or something like that, that audits the kosher level. So every place is obligated to have their local rabbinate certify their products. That's a legal obligation. You want to call your food product or your food establishment, your eatery, kosher? So you have to have, you're obligated to have the local rabbinate certify your products or your eatery as kosher. Now, because they're obligated to certify things as kosher, it creates a multi-tiered system, because what happens now, I want to say this is kosher, right? I'm making, I have my restaurant, I have my catering, or I have my factory where I'm producing some sort of packaged snack. And I want to call it kosher. And I'm convinced that it's kosher. And not only am I convinced that it's kosher, I've looked into my product and everything I do in order to make my product, and I will jump up and down and guarantee you that it's kosher. Why? Now, you're going to tell me, well, there might be an issue because you used gelatin in your product, for instance, right? I'm not talking about kosher gelatin, not fish gelatin, not kosher beef gelatin. I'm not getting into all those stories. I'm talking about they used regular, the regular old-fashioned pig gelatin. So you're going to, but I'm sure, I looked into this, and there are rabbis that maintain that it's fine, that it went through a process that renders it okay to be used, and you come and you tell me that it's not kosher. Well, I say, no, it is kosher. And I start pulling out svarim from my svarim shelf, and I show you, it's kosher. There are rabbis that say it's kosher. So now what do you do? It's true, there are opinions that maintain that it's okay to use, definitely in certain instances, depending on exactly how it's being used in the food product, perhaps as well. But under certain circumstances, it might be permissible to use quote-unquote non-kosher gelatin. So now that that's said and done, so what happens? Most people who keep kosher don't eat gelatin, don't eat non-kosher gelatin. But there are big rabbanim, Reb Chaim Eizer, who was one of the biggest poskim in his times in pre-war Europe, and various other poskim throughout Europe and America, maintained that it was kosher. So what does the rabbinate do when they're faced with such a challenge? So it's difficult for them to say that it's not kosher. So they're going to, they might certify something like that as kosher, but it's a very basic level of kosher without any chumros, without any, not only no chumros, but with lots of leniencies that are embedded in it, because at the end of the day, I can't say it's not kosher. We'll take a different instance. You know, I want to explain a little bit of the overall background to get to why it is how it is, and then what happened, what occurs. So now what happens is I might have a different type of instance. You know what? We'll talk about Pesach in this instance. When it comes to Pesach, there's a halacha, right, which many of us try to use this halacha to our benefit, even if we're being super strict. But not under all circumstances do we want to rely on this halacha. And that's a halacha called bittul, nullifying, something that's in general we might use it with not kosher or with basar b'chalav, right, with milk and meat. Somebody accidentally, one of the most frequent questions we get asked in the kashrus department is somebody used their fleishik soup mix in a milchik pot, or they used it in a soup that they put something milchiks into or something like that. And now the question is, how fleishik is that fleishik soup mix, right? So we have concepts of bittul where we'll discuss how many parts per however much water and everything else that you mixed into it was actually really meaty that would create it to be, that we have to deal with in terms of deciding whether it's kosher or not, at least b'di'evit or something like that, right, post facto. So when you have something that was mixed in a very minute amount, it becomes nullified. Now, that very minute amount might be chametz before Pesach getting mixed into something which is kosher Pesach. Where do we almost all try to use this? In the worst case scenario, is when we bake matzos. I don't know if anybody ever saw anybody baking matzos on Pesach. Well, you're allowed to, in theory, if you're very particular to make sure that everything's done properly, you can do it on Pesach. But how come nobody does? Because, what? The Taimanim used to. Nowadays, I don't think they really do. But they used to. That was because their matzahs spoiled, since they made soft matzahs, you got 8 days in. Now there's freezers, so they don't have to. But the issue with making matzos on Pesach, while it's permissible, is that if the most minute amount of chametz develops in the matzah baking, and you know, this was always when I was newly wed, so I went to bake matzos for about a few years. And those that still call me newlywed, married almost 15 years, but so when I went to bake matzos the first few years, I baked with a certain group of friends, and one of the organizers there was a very tense person. And you can imagine, it's matzo baking in 18 minutes, and water, flour, everything going on. And so I always had like this friend who would go over to him, he's like, hey, Shepsel, you want some pizza? I snuck a piece of pizza in here. And he would go like berserk. Right, but I always thought it was ironic because one of the places we have the most chametz in the entire world, however ironic this sounds, is in a matzah bakery. You go into a matzah bakery, right? You're mixing flour and water, and there's all sorts of pieces that fall off. These guys, they're rolling the dough fast and quick and whatever it is. Everybody's running. Nobody has time to clean up there like as they go along. It's not like, you know, some neat housewife or something making a recipe in the kitchen, or some fancy chef, or whatever it is, that they're cleaning up after themselves, you know, a little bit of sugar, a little bit of salt, then they put the salt and the sugar back, now some black pepper, they move around to the other cat, put it back, and they go to the fridge to get whatever ingredients is from the fridge. No, it doesn't work like that. It's a super fast pace. And whatever dough's around, knock it off. We can't have that around, it's chametz, so they knock it off. But almost inevitably, tiny bits are going to get stuck somewheres, and in the process might somehow get mixed back into to the dough, as many precautionary steps as we take. So before Pesach, if that happens, it's a minute amount, and we can say that it was batel, it's nullified, because it's minute. It might even be one per 1,000. But on Pesach, if you have one per 1,000,000 parts, one of the big ceremonies that they do in Israel before Pesach is they cut off the Israeli water supply. Why? Because all you need is one fisher, an Arab fisher, it doesn't have to be a Jew, who takes his sandwich and he's sitting in the Kinneret and he's fishing his fish in his fishing boat. And while he's eating his sandwich, not because he's even using that bread as bait, but definitely if he's using it as bait for like the minnows on the seashore, but he might have taken a bite of his sandwich in his boat and a little piece falls into the Kinneret, that one little tiny piece might be problematic on Pesach because it's not batel even in billion parts. Okay, I don't want to really talk about the Kinneret because maybe we could be lenient in such a scenario because... So yeah, it's the chief rabbin, it goes the day before Pesach, and not Erev Pesach itself, it's usually the day before, where they close off, they secure closed water supplies enough to last through Pesach so that they shouldn't have to worry about things like that happening over Pesach. Okay, so now there are many people who are makbid, the whole Pesach, that are particular, the whole Pesach, to use only bottled water, the whole Pesach. And they buy, when I made Pesach at home, that's what I would do also, I bought, I thought it was a nice chomer to try to do. And so we'd go out, we'd buy lots and lots and lots of whatever the cheapest brand of bottled water was, because it wasn't really for drinking, it was for cooking, it was for making the chicken soup and for mixing it. There was no challah to make, so it wasn't getting mixed into the challah dough. But whatever else needed water, not for washing our hands or whatever, but anything that was food, that had a food purpose to it. So there are people who are particular to even go that extra step and use only bottled water. But... or that they have big tanks in some of the ultra, ultra orthodox neighborhoods where they don't want to use any of the electricity and Shabbos, just a whole different story. So they have these big tanks of water on their roof where they use that they use every Shabbos. So some people will just use that. They fill them up before Pesach. If it's big enough, it can last 7 days, at least for cooking purposes. Again, they're not going to shower with that water necessarily. That would be like... No, I mean, we'll talk about that afterwards, but you're washing the dishes, it's not staying on. I don't think you have to worry about that after it's dried or whatever. There's nothing from the water there anymore. Anyway, I mean, I'm sure, you know, it's chumras, you can go take it to wherever you want, whether you need to and whether there's any reason to, probably, I can't imagine it. You want it to, if you find somebody that did it, you probably can find somebody that does it. Anyway, so we have that concept of bittul. So now I'm making my Pesach products. I have a Pesach bakery and I bake all sorts of different products. And yeah, I know there's all sorts of stuff. I didn't clean my ceiling and yeah, I bake all year round and it's like, it's kind of a dirty spoon. It's a good thing my consumers don't really see the bakery. And so I didn't clean my ceiling. I don't clean the walls and whatever it is. And yeah, you know, when a tin bangs against the wall or a big cart hits something that hits the ceiling, something might fall into it. So a more strict hashgacha will be concerned about it. They'll say, that's bittul. Where, you know, there's chametz around that might get mixed in. And they could have avoided it. It's not like something, it's not like the matzah bakeries where there isn't many ways around that possible inevitable amount that might get mixed in. Anyway, so that's the reason why most people don't do it on Pesach. Because on Pesach, the halacha is that on Pesach, there's no such thing as bittul, like we said about the water. And so that's why most people won't bake their matzah on Pesach. But getting back to the different levels. So somebody might rely on that bittul. Let's go a step further about the nullifying. Somebody might rely on it on ingredients, meaning, let's say flavorings, okay? When you're making a cake at home, okay, somebody's baking a cake, so what goes into the cake? Some flour, some water, some sugar, some eggs, maybe a little bit of vanilla, right? And if they're not so health conscious and whatever it is, they might make a nice frosting. And in the frosting, they might put in some margarine or shortening, and they might put in some creamer and maybe some food coloring. Okay, now that food coloring has a nice color green to it. Okay, and that in Israel, it's hard to get the natural vanilla flavoring. Okay, so that vanilla flavoring, it smells like vanilla, and it has a very potent vanilla taste. Now, both that green food coloring and that vanilla that quote-unquote vanilla extract, I don't know if it ever saw a vanilla bean in its life, but it has hundreds, if not possibly thousands of components in it, okay? Then the books we have in OU Kashrus, one of the things that we pride ourselves on is knowing all the ingredients that go into everything, okay? We get from the companies all ingredients. Flavoring companies are like the most complicated. Why? Because there's so many ingredients that go into each flavoring. So somebody might say, okay, but like that's ridiculous because the flavoring itself is a minute amount in the food product, right? Because you're only putting in 2 drops of that vanilla flavoring into your dough mixture, okay, for your batter, whatever, for the cake. And in there, right, we just said there's 100 components, let's say. So out of the 100 components, there's a few parts of alcohol that might be chametz alcohol. Okay, so that's batel. Come on. It's like commandalese. It's as if it's non-existent even. Well, I'm going to tell you something. Now, everybody makes a big deal about MSG. You know how much MSG they put into the food products that have MSG? Just a tiny pinch into a huge amount. It's mamish. It's literally, it's tiny amounts. Like when you see it and you're like, what, that's what they're making a big deal out of? But you know what? Maybe they're right, because people do get headaches from the MSG and whatever it is, even though it's just a tiny bit. Okay? So you say, but like it's ridiculous. You're gonna say that this is chametz because there was in one of the ingredients there was another ingredient that had another ingredient that was chametz. So there are leniencies. I can tell you, yeah, okay, it's about so now you're gonna tell me there's another klal that we say a nosing tam, something which is there for the purpose of giving a potent taste to the food. Isn't batel, doesn't get nullified because it's there. You're always going to be able to taste it. When you bite into that cake, you taste the vanilla, right? So in the vanilla extract, you might that alcohol is there for a very important purpose. So now I'm going to come with another svara, another rabbinic logic, and I'm going to tell you there's something called zegorim v'zegorim. There's two things that are giving the same taste, right? Because there's 100 components in it. Not so it's likely just like soap, right? If you ever look at the ingredients in a soap bar, there's many similar ingredients. You'll have like 5 ingredients from the glycol family. Okay, you can have 2 types of gelatin. You can have a few of the same very similar ingredients. So there's minor differences between the two of them, but probably the soap would work to emulsify to whatever you have on your hands, regardless, you know, even if you'd skip one or two of those ingredients. It's true that all of them together enhance it, and it has, you know, that's why whatever dish soap works better than the other dish soap, or this soap is less abrasive or more abrasive or whatever than the other one. Because a slight difference in ingredients. But overall, it's going to do the same thing, so I still can't put my finger on exactly what it is that I'm tasting when I eat it, so it's going to be batel. So now, somebody can say, well, wait a second. But I'm using something that you purposely put in, and there's another klal, which is ein mevatlin isra l'chatchilo. You can't purposely intend to nullify something. So over here, when I took something that I knew was a problem, or quite possibly was a problem, and I put it in and said, well, it's batel, it's definitely not l'chatchilo. That's not the ideal way of doing it. Post facto, if that happened, and that's what I have to eat on Pesach, so I'm going to say, okay, it's mutter to eat, it's permissible, but that's post facto. That's not the ideal way, that's not the initial way that you want to do it. But now, I'm the rabbinate. Can I say it's not kosher? Jack just did this. Can I say that what Jack just made isn't kosher? I can't say it's not kosher. I can't say it's not kosher for Pesach. Is that what you want to buy? Quite possibly not. Okay? So what happens is that that you have a bedatz or some sort of other fancy or hashgacha, that they don't have to certify what they don't want. They can set their standards very high, maybe even higher than necessary. That I'm not talking about right now. It might be super high. That's their prerogative. They can set their standards wherever they want, whatever. Tomorrow a new rabbi can get up and he can make hashgacha that only has chumas. It's his prerogative. Do you want to buy it or not? So you can say it's not worth the money to me. But he's able to do that. So what happens is these other hashgachos, the super mahadran hashgachos, they're certifying the product. And they say, they know that what's going to happen is this product, it's, you're not going to find it in a bag of angel's bread that it says Nimot HaShana Bilvad, because nobody's baking angel's bread for Pesach. But a product that maybe some people are making for Pesach, right? It could be some sort of chocolate bar or something like that. It doesn't have anything inherently chametz, but it might have some of these flavorings that could be a problem. It might have things that are just kitnios, and it's an Ashkenazi Ashkacha that doesn't want to certify kitnios for Pesach. So it might be all sorts of different reasons that the one Ashkacha is going to have issues with such a product being kosher for Pesach. They know that this product is going to be continued to be made for Pesach, albeit either with a different Hashkacha or the basic Rabbanot. And therefore, they put on it the Yemot HaShana Bilvad. If that's the scenario, they're saying that it excludes even when it's in Jeredan kosher for Pesach. Right? There's no contradiction. They're not certifying it even if it's in Jeredan kosher for Pesach because they put a stipulation not for Pesach. So that inkjet is only for the other hashkachos in the package, other than the one that had the disclaimer for year-round use only. So that's right. Usually it's not very well could be. You know, it's usually on some level it might be kosher for Pesach. It's not a level that they're comfortable with certifying for Pesach. So whoever doesn't have a disclaimer is certifying them for Pesach. Right. You know, so you'll see the Rabbanot doesn't have a disclaimer next to the Rabbanot, or some sort of Al Hashgacha, some Sofer B'nai Brak or whatever it is, might be printed on the package somewhere also, and they don't have that disclaimer. So then they would be the ones who are taking responsibility that it's kosher for Pesach. If you have inkjet and you have an Eda Charedis or a Rav Landau or a Rav Rubin or whatever other fancy Hashgacha you have on it, and it doesn't have inkjet on it, and it doesn't stipulate underneath it or right above it or right next to it, Limot HaShana B'Vad for year-round use only, and then you see Kasher LePesach inkjetted on it, it would also then be that Bedatz is taking responsibility for Pesach, by and large. Okay, those are the general rules of thumb when you're trying to figure out the certification on a package that has one disclaimer that says it's not for Pesach, another one says it is for Pesach, and or when nobody says anything and it's just inkjetted on. It depends on the level of kashrus that you usually would keep. So it's hard for me to answer that as a blanket statement, because, you know, I'm going to explain to you like this. I'll give you an example. Diet Coca-Cola in Israel, okay? So they're getting syrup that's certified OU kashrus LePesach, okay? But on the other hand, so if you want to use the Coca-Cola, it's no different than the Diet Coca-Cola in America. We know that. But the Rav Landau, Zichrono Livracha, did not want to certify it because there were certain ingredients that he didn't review himself personally for year-round use. He reviewed all the ingredients but went into the regular Coca-Cola he was able to review. And he didn't want to certify it with his chotemet, with his certification, without knowing all the particulars firsthand. Okay, so therefore it has the Rabbanut of Tel Aviv on it for Pesach, on the Diet Coca-Cola. So that I would use in my house because I know what the issue is. I know why this Bedatz isn't certifying it and the other Rabbanut isn't. But, right, no, so that's what I'm telling you. So it's a hard question for me to answer because there are products that I certainly would not, because I know they're relying on leniencies. Right, because they're relying on leniencies. I'm not going to tell you it's not kosher for Pesach, because there's somebody who's certifying it, and I'm sure they're relying on reliable principles in halacha, but it might not be the most ideal principles in the first place. So usually, on a personal level, yes, I definitely keep Mahadran standards. If you ask me what I recommend, I definitely recommend overall Mahadran standards because of this background, that the Rabbanut is, because it's a legal body, they're limited that anything which is technically kosher, they have to say it's kosher. Technically kosher might mean yes. You know, if that happened in my kitchen on Friday and it's nearing Shabbos, I would use it also. But if I'm going out to the store and I'm buying things and I'm paying money for it, I might as well pay money for the thing that is kosher in the most ideal way possible. If it's on the cellophane, kosher LePesach, inkjetted on, kilo mutpas, printed on the cellophane, that it's kashrus LePesach. Whatever hashkachos are on the package that do not stipulate that they don't certify the product for Pesach will be certifying it for Pesach. If it's not written, Yemot HaShana Bilvad, then they are taking responsibility for Pesach also. If it's something that they have an issue with for Pesach, it's their obligation to stipulate Yemot HaShana Bilvad. Then the inkjet goes on any hashgacha. It could be five hashgachos on the package. It will go for all five of them. Inkjet is when it's just printed on. It's like the bar, usually like the date, like the expiration code or whatever it is, has that type of, you know.
As far as you didn't bring any visuals, just because there are some standards we can look for and you can explain.
That's a good point, and maybe in the future we'll try to do that. Thank you.
What about stickers if they cut your face?
Okay. You're asking an excellent question, and this is a question that most Anglo-Saxons ask in Israel. And the reason for that is in America, we always tell people that the OU has to be printed on the original package. Okay? And we say that if you look at any of our Tu'udot, our what we call LOCs, License of Certifications, you'll see that it says on it, symbol required, and the symbol is required on the packaging. So when somebody just sticks a sticker on, it doesn't work. We will make exceptions sometimes if the DNA of the product, so to speak, is on that sticker also. Meaning the sticker is quite identifiably, belongs to the company, it has the manufacturer's address, it has the product name, not just the company name, it has all the details that are necessary, that it could be a label in of itself, then we might allow it. Because sometimes the packaging itself, right? You buy a cake and the original packaging is a sticker on top of it. So if it has the main and important information on it, we will usually allow it. What I'll tell you is like this. In Israel, the stickers are used more frequently. There's multiple reasons for that. I'm going to be very fair, and I'm not going to be critical. And the fair reason for that is as follows. You know, I'll tell you a little bit about what I do in Israel. I certify all the OU products that are made in Israel. How many OU products are made in Israel? You know, when you look at the number of companies that we have around the world, it's probably less than a percentage. Because Israel's it's a small, let's face it, as much as the whole world's talking about it, size-wise, it's pretty small. Okay, there's certain types of products that we certify a lot of over here. But we certify 70% of the products that we're responsible for in Israel probably are Pesach products. And probably about 70% of the products you can get in the kosher market in America are also Pesach products. Why is that? Very simple. In America, you go to Nabisco, I don't know, right? And you tell them, okay, you want to make kosher Pesach cookies? It's really easy. You can do it. I mean, everybody does at home, right? A little bit of potato starch, and if you use gebrach, even easier, right? It's not such a big deal. Every Jewish family makes Pesach cookies. You can make them also, right? So I'm going to tell you, what does it require? So you say, well, you have to stop. You have to clean your line thoroughly, thoroughly, thoroughly. Can't use it for 24 hours. And then we're going to come, a team of rabbis are going to come, they're going to blowtorch your whole line and whatever it is. What? Are you crazy? And then I can, for that whole week, I can only manufacture. It's not like one run and I could do like a regular run of the regular Nabisco cookies or whatever it is. You mean for like if however many days I need to produce whatever it is I need for Passover. So I have to do it straight. I can't do anything else in between. So you're telling me like 1 week I can't manufacture anything, and that's plus 2 days that I can't use the machine. I'm cleaning and then I'm koshering and whatever it is. You got to be out of your mind, right? But in Israel, everybody needs those cookies because the country is a Jewish country, so almost everybody's keeping kosher Pesach, and that's what they're selling in all the stores and whatever it is. They need that kosher Pesach food. So all the big companies, whatever, you know, whatever the names you can think of, Elite and Strauss and whatnot, right? They're all closing down, Osem. They're all closing down, and they are doing that because that's an integral part of their market. So they do that. And once they're doing that, so the people in America, they need food for Pesach also. They're going to take advantage. There's a few smart Jewish businessmen, a few, and they've discovered this, and so they start exporting all these products to America so that you go in the supermarket in America or in England or anywhere else around the globe, and you're in the kosher store, and you have a lot of products. Most of them are coming from Eretz Yisrael. But because in Eretz Yisrael, all these companies are doing it, for some of them, they're small, they're not so big, and it becomes quite cumbersome and expensive for them to start reprinting new labels, brand new labels, mitchila ad sof, on the whole packaging. I'll tell you a great story. We had a company that we had issues with every year. Why? Because they made nice stickers that had all the details. The problem was that we kept on having issues with them with the ingredients. The ingredients said in the back, flour, yeast, it had like all sorts of inherently chametz stick ingredients, and every year we got questions about it. You know what stopped them? Was when the health department caught them. So Sometimes the health department says, you know, what do you mean? You don't have these ingredients, you have other ingredients. It has to be very clear what ingredients are in there and what ingredients aren't. So the point is, but in Israel, it's accepted because everybody knows that, you know, it's Pesach, it's 1 week, give them some slack. It's kind of like building your sukkah on the sidewalk, right? It's understood, it's sukkahs. So take my parking space, take my sidewalk, whatever it is. And yet, I also need a sukkah, so I'll take your sidewalk, you take my sidewalk, and we're good to go, okay? So, it's accepted because it's difficult not to. But the sticker has to have enough identifying information for it to be considered what's called a chotam, a seal. Meaning, if it's just a sticker that anybody could have stuck onto anything and it's not traceable, so that probably isn't sufficient. If the sticker has a little bit of information about the product name, a company, it has something that identifies it, that yes, this sticker belongs to this product, so then it's probably fine.
So sticker just says kosher Pesach, not fine? But inkjet...
You can call up the relevant Ashgacha to ask him if you really want to, but ideally that's not what should be. Because that's on the wrapper itself. It's printed onto the wrapper itself from the company. Why is that different than the label? Just because it's not as nice, it's not as fancy. They just spared the graphics. That's it. Well, here, a sticker, you know, it's removable, somebody can put it on. But if it's done very well and it's very clear that this was done in the factory, in the plant, in the company, whatever it is, and it's on well and the shkacha can stand behind it, then it should be fine. Welcome.
So, thank you. Will most places have sections, or will they be integrated into everything else?
So, I'll tell you, I actually had a problem. I have a problem now shopping. If you go into the strictly religious supermarkets, meaning like in the, you know, if you go to what they call mixed neighborhoods, like in Rehavia, you don't have this problem. But if you go out to Beit Vegan, that would be a good example, whatever it is, you can't buy crackers there already. It's like impossible. So I go to the Maharajan supermarkets, and I don't have anything to buy. My kids need crackers to go to school with, and there's no crackers there already because they already stacking their shelves with all the chametz products and start putting on more and more Pesach, and already, you know, until Purim they keep it on because of Mishloach Manos, and then the day after Purim, every day there's less and less and less and less. So, but if you go to the more the mixed neighborhoods and these types of things, so the neighborhood right next to my house here in Rehavia, so the supermarket there, they have, so they still have all the chametz, but also they're slowly sectioning off, they're diminishing it a little bit, and then they start covering the shelves and running kashrut Pesach, and you know slowly it starts to whatever until it comes, you know, Erev Pesach, and there's, you know, just a few random shelves here and there that they seal off with big white tablecloths and write on it, chametz, machor legoy, or whatever it is that they write on it, right? Something to that effect, and until the end of Pesach. So the shuk, it depends on each store individually. You know, you'll have stores that are more geared to, you know, because they're planning on selling mostly Pesach products or whatever it is, so they'll start, transferring over to Pesach gradually, and some of them, you know, depending on how important it is, their Pesach section and their Pesach shoppers, depends on the speed that they'll do it in. Whereas, you know, if you have like a bakery that is inherently chametz, and they're just going to be closed for Pesach, they're on vacation, so they'll be fully stocked until Erev Pesach. You know, you can go in there and get your French baguettes and your Italian bread and whatever else. Okay, we actually just got this question because originally it was an article published in our Things That They Can't, and then more recently, Rabbi Belsky, Zichrono Livracha, one of the OU Poskim, my Rabbi, he, after he reviewed it, he decided that it could be kasher. Just like any other marble, which means, you know, like any other stone. So you have to make sure that it's really clean beforehand. Go over it, make sure, you know, with your hands slowly, make sure there aren't crevices, because there's crevices that need to be cleaned out very well. Take a toothpick or whatever it is. A little bit of bleach never hurts. Even on Caesar stone, they might tell you not to use it. In my experience, it doesn't ruin it. I don't want to take responsibility on yours, don't sue me, but in my experience, it doesn't. And boiling water. Even though it says, it's actually interesting, when you buy the Caesar stone, they tell you not to put down hot on it. But it comes with a tuda from Mechon Somet that says that it's kasherable by purging with water. So it's actually, I always found that very amusing. But also, I'll tell you, again, my personal experience is that it doesn't break unless it's very old or put it down in a faulty manner. And I only had one time that it ever happened that it cracked, but it was a very old and a sloppy job also on how it was done. It was a kitchen that we kashered for like a caterer that was using it, and it was kind of just like a hop-lop job, you know, just slap down quickly or whatever, not very well even. And that thing had, you know, hadn't been cleaned properly in years. It was nice and old or whatever it was. And that was the only time I had it happen that it cracked. Otherwise, in my house, kasher it every year with boiling water. Hasn't cracked it. And we put down hot pots on it also during the year. Okay, so dishwashing soap, the OU maintains, does not have to be kasher l'Pesach. There are those that maintain it should be kasher l'Pesach, but the OU maintains that it does not need to be kasher l'Pesach. OU maintains it does not need to have hashgacha during the year. And it doesn't need to have hashgacha. No, there's more reason that the shampoo you're using should be kosher than the dish soap you're using should be kosher, actually. It doesn't need to be kosher. The shampoo does not need to be kosher. I said, but there would be more reason for that to be kosher than for the dish soap you're using to be kosher. The OU has a website, right? Most of the information that we have on the website is applicable to Israel as well in terms of the technical types of stuff. In terms of products, it's very different here, and in America, we're the primary certification. In Israel, we're not the primary certification for the local market, so it doesn't really make sense because most of the products we're certifying aren't necessarily in the market here. Some of the stuff that we are certifying in theory, over here being sold with a different local hashgacha, so it becomes much more complicated. Now, just to clarify though, in general, I'm not saying this is without any exception, but in general, the Osem products that in America have an OUP and over here they have a Chasam Sofer B'nei Brak are the same thing. Likewise, the Telma products, the Unilever, like Knorr or whatever it is, types of products that in America have an OUP on it, and here they have a Chasam Sofer B'nei Brak. It's the same product, same productions, just Israeli wrappers for years. That's how they, that's how they sell. And yeah, I said Unilever, Telma, the Knorr label, whatever it is. Those types of products that you're used to seeing in America with an OUP. What? I said Unilever. But it's not limited to those. It's a product. It's definitely worth asking us. You can shoot us an email asking us about a product. But in general, the products that you're familiar seeing in America with an OUP, and over here you see with Chasam Sofer B'nei Brak, most often that's going to be the hashgacha you'll see here instead of the OUP. Chasam Sofer B'nei Brak, it's a circular hashgacha. So most often that's the same exact product as what we're certifying to America. Most often. Not always. It's definitely worth asking. If you want to double check, you can send an email to... And then we have it all over the place. It's in the Torah Tidbits, kashrut at ouisrael.org. We don't necessarily certify those for Pesach. We don't necessarily certify them for Pesach. OU kidney oats. Some of them are OU kidney oats, so you have to be careful. The must, I don't remember certifying for Pesach so much. Again, I don't want to say for sure. Maybe there was one year, yes. It's not something that we can't certify for Pesach. The company has to be willing to buy slightly more expensive ingredients to make it non-kitnios. When they make it non-kitnios, but elite products in general in Israel, if it's certifiable as OU, will have the OU on it, just like during year-round. If it has an OUP on it, no. If it has OU kitnios, we have a separate symbol that's very clearly identifiable as OU kitnios. No, it's OU, it's a square box. And it says OU kidney oat, and then it says may be consumed by those who, by those who consume legumes on Passover or something like that. It has a.
As long as you're on that topic, can you talk a little bit more about the pitfalls and shopping and problems with kidney
oat? Okay, so problems with kidney oat should generally be taken care of. That stipulation that we talked about before, meaning that. Again, the higher end, the Ashkenazi Ashkachos that aren't willing to certify kitniot, will usually have a stipulation on a product which is likely only kitnios. Let's say, let's talk about beans, right? Something which is like the mainstay kitnios, right? Everybody knows that baked beans are kitnios. There's nothing else wrong with the product. Let's say the tomato sauce would be totally kosher Pesach without any, but it could be that the tomato sauce also has corn syrup or something like that in it, or citric acid that's kitniot or something like that. But let's say that they're using tomato sauce that has no other issues with it. It's totally fine. So now I have the baked beans, I know that somebody might certify it for Pesach because the only issue with it is kitniot. So I'll put next to my hashkacha limot hashana bilvar, because I don't certify kitniot on Pesach. Not me, though. You does certify, but with a separate stipulation. In general, though, next to the inkjet, it will say Lo'ochle Kitniot. We'll say Kasher LePesach, Kashlap, you know, the initials, the acronym, Kashlap, Lo'ochle Kitniot Dovad. It generally will state that.
But that means that there could be instances where it could be only
Lo'ochle
Kitniot, but it doesn't say that.
No, there should not be such instances. I can't take responsibility for products that we don't certify, that doesn't happen. No. Our products, if it doesn't have an OU kitniot symbol on it, and if it has an OUP on it, there's no problem with kitniot. If it doesn't have an OUP or an OU kitniot, then it's not kosher for Pesach. And if it has OU kitniot, then it's certainly kitniot. Okay, health is not my department. I'll send you to speak to my wife about health. She's a dietitian. It's not quite my department. I have to tell you something, that my wife always says that the French fries taste much better on Pesach, and I said, yeah, it's the same reason why KFC tastes so much better than any other schnitzel you have anywhere else. The reason why is KFC doesn't fry their schnitzels in oil, they fry them in shortening. Okay, so the Pesach French fries that are fried in palm oil is basically a shortening, so that it actually tastes better. But yes, it's definitely less healthy. But health is in my department. I can't I can't talk about that. Not in this direction or that direction. So the oils that are most readily available on the market in Israel as being kosher for Pesach is usually the palm oil and olive oil, obviously. So olive oil has a stronger taste, it's more potent, and it's not necessarily good for frying or that type of stuff, but for other recipes where it could be used, cooking, that's definitely a viable option. In Israel, you actually don't have so much cottonseed oil available at all, because the Rabbanut views cottonseed oil as being kitniot. We do certify it in Israel, but much more on the bulk type of level. It's hard to find as a consumer, although some more and more every year I see some of the, especially in the more American area, the supermarkets are starting to import like Geffen cottonseed oil. There's walnut oil usually available on the Israeli market. You have grapeseed oil, which is supposed to be a slightly healthier, or much healthier actually, alternative, but it's very expensive. What? Grapeseed oil? Again, I can't tell you. I don't stock a supermarket, so I can't tell you, exactly where you can and can't. But in general, they do sell it. And I'll actually let you in on a little secret. It used to be, I don't know if it's still current, because I haven't made Pesach for a bunch of years. But it used to be that, particularly next to the Belz area, they had grapeseed oil available. The reason for that is that the Belzers do not use palm oil. They didn't have palm oil in Belz, so they don't use palm oil. But they do use grapeseed oil. So therefore, it was like a special product that you were able to find in by the supermarket on Shamgar next to Bell's. They used to sell it. I don't know if that's still the case, but that might be it might be a clue in the right direction.
What about safflower oil?
What?
Safflower oil. I know
these states. With what
hashgacha?
With OU? Okay, I haven't seen it here. Okay, sapphire oil has. Okay, I don't know enough about it. I can't comment because it's not something that's really available here, at least to the best of my knowledge. Coconut oil, if you get it, if it's available with it, there's, you might find it in some of the bigger supermarkets. Again, you have to keep bear in mind that a neighborhood that's selling to smaller consumers, meaning it's in neighborhoods where it's more, that it's more retirees and or Dafka very young couples or something like that, you're less likely that they have less products because they're selling on a much smaller scale, so they don't bring in as many products for Pesach. Whereas if you go out to the supermarkets in some of the neighborhoods, the very Orthodox neighborhoods that have a lot of big families who are making Pesach and whatever it is, they have 10 kids or 8 kids or 6 kids or 5 kids, they'll have a lot more products because they're selling to people who are buying in much greater volume. So all you need is one person there who wants a certain type of oil or whatever it is for Pesach, and they're buying already the same amount that 5 people in the other neighborhood would buy. So it's sometimes it's worthwhile to go out to some of these big supermarkets in the primarily Orthodox areas where they're buying a lot of these types of products because they'll have a greater variety of options.
What's
in cottonseed oil, the Rabbanut, I think it's historically, it went back to a historical argument between 2 rabbis in Israel. Frankly, probably the one who maintained that it was kitnios wasn't so familiar with cotton cereal, because it's very difficult to say something which is only used. Some people have an issue with why canola oil, rapeseed oil, is considered kitnios. So just to explain why that's considered kitnios very briefly, is because rapeseed is actually very close. It's in the mustard family. It's not so palatable because it's very strong and bitter, but it isn't in the mustard family. So because it's part of the mustard family, we can say, that we kind of say it's that family is a problem. Even though this is a variety that nobody would eat, it's still a problem. But cottonseed, nobody eats cottonseeds. Nobody eats cottonseed, right? So the idea is they probably, whoever it was, either didn't fully understand or had a different reason why he wanted to forbid it. But the OU still maintains, even in Israel, and Rav Landau, Zichrono Levracha, was actually a big proponent. He very much encouraged the use of cottonseed oil in Israel against the Rabbanut standards, but as not being a kitniot option. And so where it's available with OUP, gesunte, hey, buy it. We certify hotels for Pesach, and I've told them that they can use, even though we say that it doesn't have kidney oils or whatever it is, we've told them that they can use cottonseed oil. Peanuts are not considered kidney oils by everybody, but... In Israel, it's basically accepted as being kidney oils. Can't say that it's accepted by everybody as kidney oils, and Ramosha Feinstein didn't view it as being kidney oils. But in America, most Ashkachos also will view it as kitnios because, again, the vast majority of the tzibur views it as kitnios also.
You said that you certify hotels. You certify restaurants?
On Pesach, we have, aside from in the Ramada, the restaurants are open there and we certify the Ramada. But aside from that, Papagayo and Tapiot will be open on Pesach, Be'ezrat Hashem, as Kashal Pesach. Okay, I mean, Toveling isn't directly related to Pesach, if you're talking about Toveling.
I guess what I mean is, what falls in the category that you have to...
Okay, so if something is metal, it needs to be Toveled with a bracha. If it's glass, it needs to be Toveled without a bracha. That's Midir Rabbanan.
You're asking about Havdalah, or you're asking about... Tzibur?
You're asking about koshering it in boiling water, or you're talking about taking it to the mikvah? Okay, so tevila. No. So tevila is done when you buy a new, and not necessarily new, but something that was owned previously by a non-Jew. Okay, either that it was made by a non-Jew in the factory and he owned it originally, or something that a non-Jew bought in between and then sold to you. Okay, but if something's already in your house, in your possession, you tovled it years ago when you bought it, and now you're koshering it for Pesach. Then what you need to do is to kosher it. There's different methods of kashering. There's purging, which is with boiling water. And then there is, and then there's what we refer to as libun, which is scorching. And that could be, there's two levels of scorching. There's libun kal and libun chamor. Libun kal is that to the extent that if you would have something like a paper on the other side of it, really Chazal talk about, the rabbis in the time of the Gemara talk about straw, but really nowadays I guess, you know, paper would be something that you have around the house more frequently than a piece of straw. So if you put that on the other side of the kli, you're koshering by torching or by scorching it.
They have big baths here?
So here, the easiest way, anything that's mobile, the easiest way to do it is in most neighborhoods, again, definitely in the vastly Orthodox neighborhoods, they have hagala, they have koshering stations next to a shul usually, or next to a mikvah or something like that, where you give them a nominal payment of, you know, 5 shekel, 10 shekel, whatever it is, and then they either, you know, they have blow torches there, and they have big vats of boiling hot water, and they'll do that for you, and that's the easiest way around it. You have something.
Aware that a lot of them are run by kids that don't know what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, and right, the Israel Dal next to the orange, the Bate Orange Din Mikvah. You have it next to Satmar, you have next to Bells, you have on every Friday. But definitely before Pesach, you have them. And it's important to make sure, as I'm sorry, I don't know your name, but as was pointed out, that the people who are doing it are competent. In other words, you go to a place, you see that it's a bunch of kids that unlikely know what they're doing, aside from the fact that you don't want to take a part in the danger that's going on there. And how high the police would shut these kids down, but it would do everybody a favor, it would do them a favor for their safety, and it would do the rest of us a favor for our kashrus. But it's important to make sure that somebody who's competent. And you see somebody, an adult, that seems to know what he's doing, you know, not somebody who. Yeah. No, it's fine. But I think we're about to come to an end now. I'm going to have to run out, so let's take just one or two last questions. Okay, an electric oven, according to Moshe Feinstein, ovens need libun chomer, which we didn't discuss exactly the temperature, but that's that it would glow, so to speak. Galvanized metal is never going to glow, no matter how hot you get it to, or almost never going to glow. But you still could achieve that by reaching such a temperature. In a home electric oven, you're not going to be able to get to a libun chomer. Most poskim maintain that a libun kal was enough for an oven. I can't get into all the reasons behind why yes or why not. Therefore, it's okay to be lenient like most of the poskim and to kasher it with what's called a libun kal. That would be accomplished by A, cleaning out the oven very well. You know, it's making sure there's nothing of any substance left there. So if you have something discoloring on the wall that can't be removed, that, you know, no matter how much you scratch it, it doesn't change at all, that's just discoloring of the metal, and that's fine. But if it's something that when you scratch at, it removes, you know, you're able to remove more of it, so then you have to continue to work on it more and more and more until you finally get that all off. Once it's clean, you leave it for 24 hours not using it, right, cold, for 24 hours, and then after it was left for 24 hours, you turn it on to its highest temperature. If it's an oven, most of the ovens here have a convection setting, a non-convection setting, you know, with a fan, without a fan. What you should do is then first turn it on with the fan for about 45 minutes on its hottest setting, and then about another 45 minutes on the hottest setting without the fan. Also, what's a good idea is with the fan, if you can't, you know, some of them it's easy to remove some sort of panel on top of the fan to clean the fan area. That's ideal. If you can't remove the panel, it's not made in such a fashion that you can do it unless it would be mamish taking totally apart and then you're going to just break your oven, whatever it is. So then if that's the case, that you can't really take it apart and clean that area, so you should spritz like the oven cleaner, the degreaser, the St. Moritz or whatever brand you're using, into that area so that it should be pogem, that it should, so to speak, make it unedible, whatever was left there, and then continue with the prescribed formula.
My oven has an element at the top, and it's not removable, so I can't clean any grease that's spattered up above the element. So do I have a problem with being able to cover that?
Okay, so the element's total is uncovered or it's covered?
What?
The element's covered or uncovered?
No, it's uncovered.
Okay. So what do you mean by an element? Like a coil or you mean like a fan?
Yeah, the coil itself, the top, like the coil. At the top.
You're right. No, so you have to, you know, try to clean as well as you can around it, and you know, if there's a little bit of space in between, so you take either like pipe cleaners or a toothpick with a little schmata on it, you know, a little matlit or something on it, and try to go over that with degreaser and that sort of thing as well as you can. And after that, you know, make sure if you use degreaser and you got to everywhere, so you were definitely pogem, you definitely blemished the whatever was left, and then you can go on and kosher it with that, right? Then after koshering it, yeah. What kind of things? Stainless steel or? Okay, so 24 hours, you can't use hot water in it, and you can't leave water there for prolonged periods of time. If you rinse, if you wash your hands off quickly or whatever it is, what? Yeah, so the kitchen stuff is a little bit more complicated because you might have all sorts of questions about the davar charif, that maybe something was a little spicy, or you know, various different issues like that that might come up. So the kitchen stuff, it's best to try to not wash the kitchen stuff for 24 hours. The way to accomplish that, the easiest way to accomplish that is either on Shabbos, you transfer everything before Shabbos to chad pami already, you know, it's chad pami tavniyot and that type of thing, disposable aluminum pans. And then you use disposable plates and that sort of stuff. And so that way you don't have anything you need to wash. And Shabbos is 25 hours, right? No, you kosher it after Shabbos. Motzei Shabbos, the first thing you do is kosher it. Pour the boiling water, then you clean it. What?
No, a week before you smell it.
Yeah. If you want to wait till, if you're going to wait till right before, till a day or two before, so then you should try to use either your bathroom sink or bathtub or something like that to wash the dishes in. But to wash your hands off quickly, that would be with cold water, that would be fine. But to start washing dishes, you're going to enter murky areas that are better to avoid. Okay, I'm just going to take these two questions and yeah.
I'm not sure if I have because people have been bringing the food. I'm not sure if I've trained the six. I'm saying I'm using only disposable because people have been amazingly bringing in food from all different places.
Okay.
So what do I do then? I just boil the
right, same thing. You pour boiling water. You take a kumkum, then it's a kli rishon, it's the initial container that it was boiled in, right, like a regular kumkum. And you can do it twice, you know, so that way you do one half of the sink, depending on the size of the sink. If you need to do it twice, you can do it twice. Okay?
Does the kitchen faucet filter have to
be changed? No, but it should be cleaned out well. What you should do is first remove it. It's a good idea to do it anyway, because you get avnit that builds up in it. Bang it against like the counter or the sink or whatever it is so the avnit falls out. And then turn on the, let's go back a step. Before you take it off, cover it with your thumb or your palm of your hand very tight, like airtight. Turn it on. It will also clean out your pipes very well so you'll get slightly better pressure. After that, remove it, unscrew it, bang it against the counter, then turn on the water, rinse it out, and put it back on and take maybe a little bit of a sponge or something like that with soap to the No. You could. Again, it's a nice thing to do, and eventually you probably have to and whatever also. But you know, I'm not diminishing anybody who's particular to do it. Do you need to? No. Okay. Thank you very much.